Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Bridget Meads. Meads is a poet, teacher, and the co-founder of Ithaca City of Asylum, a nonprofit project that hosts dissident exiled writers in Ithaca. Her work has appeared in many magazines and anthologies, including the American Poetry Review and the Seneca Review. Her most recent book of poetry is called Audience, published in October by Vista Periodista. Welcome to the show, Bridget.
Thank you, Tish.
Now, you mentioned in your biography that you come from a large working class family in Syracuse. Now, tell us how this might have influenced you to become a writer.
Well, it's an Irish family, and my mother was a great storyteller and really had the gift of the gab. So I think I learned to use words and enjoy them pretty early on.
Mm-hmm. And when did you actually start writing? As a child?
No, I came to Ithaca in 1987 to go to music school at Ithaca College, which didn't suit me. So I left music school but stayed at IC and started taking writing classes and started writing then. So I left behind one love and moved immediately to the next.
Uh-huh. So you poetry. Found that was a good fit, huh?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Now, in 1993, you say in your biography that you studied poetry in the countryside outside Belfast, Northern Ireland. How did you end up there?
Well, my teacher at Ithaca College, Catherine Howd Mahan, stayed my friend after I graduated in 1991. And one day she gave me a flyer for a summer writing course in Port Muck, Northern Ireland, which is a very small rural town north of Belfast. And I was looking for an adventure, so off I went to this summer writing class. And I had a great time, and I found out that just that year they were beginning a master's program through a British university, Lancaster University, and they asked me if I would stay and join the program. And very quickly I decided I would and came back to Ithaca and packed up my things and left again and spent a year there. I lived in the country for 3 months, and then I moved into the city of Belfast and lived there for nearly a year. And this was pre-ceasefire Northern Ireland.
I was just going to ask you that. They called it the Troubles. But
it was the Troubles, yeah. And so it was an adventure, you know, a girl from upstate New York living in Belfast and looking at all the soldiers in their tanks and also trying to get my head around it. But it was a wonderful year in that the Irish love poetry, and my teachers were really wonderful, and I just learned an enormous amount about writing poems, including writing long poems. And I wrote a long poem when I was there that was published, and you know, I'm still writing them.
Uh-huh. And when you were taking these classes in Northern Ireland, was the writing that was coming out of you being called up from your past, or were you being influenced by your surroundings in this new country?
The main thing I wrote while I was there is a long poem called Light, and it is about, I was working in a pizza shop.
Shop in Northern Ireland?
Yes.
One would not think.
Yes. One of the favorite toppings was tuna banana. They like the tuna banana pizza in Northern Ireland, and the slogan of the shop was fast, fresh, and probably the best. But the Irish, they didn't really want to commit, but probably the best. So I was writing about living in Belfast and working in this pizza shop, but I was also writing about Syracuse and growing up there in the past. It was, you know, the nice thing about the long poem is that you can bring in enormous amounts of material, and you can move back and forth between time. Mm-hmm. Sort of like a novel in that way.
Mm-hmm. So was this your apprentice poem? Was it something that you developed while you were living there, or was it something that was just shot out of you that was waiting to come out?
Well, I wrote it over the course of a season, the spring. So it did take me 3 months to write the initial draft, and then I honed it later on. I had written a great deal in Ithaca, but I guess you'd call that my juvenilia, wouldn't you? I think what I wrote in Ireland was my first adult work that really synthesized and was my voice authentically. Mm-hmm. And it was funny, I had to go to another country to find my own voice.
I've heard other writers say that, though. That's not surprising to me.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. A little bit of a feeling of freedom, perhaps.
Well, it was very interesting to be in a country where people speak English, but with a different accent and many different meanings, and where language is very political. And that was important to me, to really be liberated in the idea that poets could be political.
Mm.
Because, you know, in the 90s in the U.S., and even now I think most of our major poets are writing intimate lyric narrative poems about their personal lives. And, you know, you do have a few writing about the wider world, but it was very exciting to see a whole generation of poets writing about the wider world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, let's turn to the new work that you just published. It's called Audience,
mm-hmm.
and it's a collection of poetry. Tell us about the theme. It's very interesting.
Well, this, again, is a long poem. I had thought for years that I wanted to write a long poem about being in audiences, because the people listening right now are in an audience. I encourage them to go and write a poem about their experience being in this audience. But being in the audience is something we do all the time and we rarely think about. And it is, you know, it's a symbol of our large society. And there's so much that happens to people in audiences in terms of them having spiritual experiences or being transported or aesthetic experiences or communal experiences. And I just thought it'd be interesting to take that and go through a year of audiences and write a poem for each audience I was in.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a long poem because they're all audience poems, but they're a series of events that I felt I was an audience to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it felt like you were the audience to your own life in some ways, not mm-hmm. just performances that you were watching,
right?
But things that
right.
you were feeling intimately
mm-hmm.
in your own life as they were passing through.
Right.
And on that note, I really would like to have you read a piece from Audience. It's called Treaty of Canandaigua Commemoration Day. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, I began this project in August 2001. And, of course, anything anyone was writing after September 11th became about September 11th. I'd gone up to Canandaigua for an annual treaty commemoration between the Haudenosaunee and the Americans. And it's, you know, the last act of warfare in our region was 200 years ago. So this, more than 200, I'm sorry, 250 years ago. So this is a commemoration of that treaty. And there's a Deborah Tall image in here. She has a wonderful poem about the albino deer at the abandoned Seneca Army Depot. And so her albino deer sneaks into this poem.
Mm.
Deborah Tall is a local poet, was a local poet. Treaty of Canandaigua Commemoration Day. The Senecas are singing, their old languages streaming, a spring bubbling up and running toward the lake. It is cold, near freezing, and my feet are growing numb on this long, sloping lawn in front of a ridiculously big courthouse in a little town full of huge, empty, run-down buildings, big enough to hold the important past which has swept by, a tide receding, leaving only flotsam of memory. 207 years ago, our people met to end decades of war, and they talked and they compromised. Haudenosaunee and American made their way to peace. A letter from the Onondaga Tododaho to President Bush is read. Our Mohawk steelworkers built those towers and the Pentagon. They are there right now, digging out. We condole with you. We urge peace. The air is full of muffled applause from gloved hands. Flocks of sparrows wheel overhead. The storm clouds are bruised purple. Driving home, I pass the burned-out house in Romulus, still smoldering. A mother and four children dead, the father the only survivor. I watch the rare albino deer behind the fence at the abandoned army base. Their pale hides glimmer in the growing dusk. ghost deer, messengers of the spirit. They have sprung from the earth to remind that living beauty can triumph over history. They eat well and are protected from hunters. Each season, there are more.
And that was lovely. We were really marching toward war when you wrote that, weren't we?
Oh, I think it was clear.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And were you moved to write a poem about that because of your concern about it? Because we weren't sure yet until it happened that it was going to happen.
No, but I think it was clear from the moment of the morning of September 11th that the U.S. government was going to take action in Afghanistan. I don't know that people could foresee the expansion of it. But, you know, I'm not the only one in this poem urging peace.
Mm-hmm.
The Onondagas were as well. And much of this book is concerned with the march towards war and the great complexity of that.
As we know more so about now.
Right. Right. I mean, the danger of writing a long poem or writing a poem about very topical events is that in retrospect you can be foolish or wrong. But I think in this one at least I was not wrong in seeing war coming.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was thinking about the links between violence on the family level and the personal level, the historical level. I was bringing, you know, the wonderful thing about the long poem is you can bring in so much and let it simmer throughout the book.
Mm-hmm.
So these themes come back over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you as a writer feel like it's your obligation to respond in some way to current events?
Well, it's my obligation to write the poem that needs to be written within me. I happen to be a poet who does write about current events. And as I said, there's a danger that that can become dated or not interesting or too local.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, I feel strongly that poetry is a wonderful form to talk about politics.
Mm-hmm.
And matters of justice.
And to suggest emotions as
right.
well as politics.
Right.
Yeah, it is a great way to do it. It's an artful way of doing it without preaching.
Well, poetry is a special language.
It is.
It's intensified. It's beautiful. It's magical language. And if you feel strongly about peace, it's a wonderful environment in which to be talking about that. In new language that can touch people and reach them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about the fact that you were the co-founder of Ithaca City of Asylum. What was the impetus behind starting this organization?
The USA Today newspaper.
You've got to be kidding me.
No, I was on my way to work one day and I saw a little headline in USA Today saying there was a poet in residence at a casino in Las Vegas. And I thought, well, I really do have to buy USA Today to figure out what's going on. And I learned that they had begun hosting their first writer in residence from a group that at that point was called the International Parliament of Writers and based in Paris, France. And so I got in touch with them. And they put me in touch with a wonderful woman named Anne Berger, who's a faculty member at Cornell, and she and I worked together to develop Ithaca City Asylum here.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought Ithaca was a perfect place for it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bridget Meads. She's a poet. Let's talk a little bit more about Ithaca City of Asylum. So how did you get in touch with writers that might have needed this particular cultural service, if you will.
We've worked with several parent organizations. The first was the International Parliament of Writers. We're now working with a group called the North American Network of Cities of Refuge. We also talked to a group called Scholars at Risk, Penn. You know, we hear from a variety of people about writers in need.
Mm-hmm.
Right now we're hosting Sarah Mikonza of Swaziland, whom you've had on your show, And she'll be with us till June, and we're currently working on finding out who will be the next writer.
It's a great organization. I think it's incredibly worthwhile for people in this community also to meet people from these other writers.
Uh-huh. And writers really do like to support other writers.
Now, can I have you read another piece from audience? This one is called Shakespeare's R&J. Tell us a little bit about it.
This is a play that was put on at the Kitchen Theater right here in Ithaca, next door to where we are right now. And they had taken Romeo and Juliet and made an exciting new version of it. And I think I was thinking about men in this poem because it was an all-male version of Romeo and Juliet. Shakespeare's R&J. It's a modern Romeo and Juliet with an all-boy cast, full of energy, drive, and thrill, the lads roughhousing about Verona, ricocheting off each other with insane joy. Romeo is knotted up and bewildered, spinning as the play swirls around him. And I'm spinning, too. I'm trying to pay attention, but I can't forget Danny Pearl, that kidnapped reporter chained in some Pakistani hole with a gun to his head, held by people making impossible demands. They're threatening to kill him tomorrow. His wife says, I believe in creating dialogue with these people. I have to. I'm pregnant. On stage, the games turn serious as Mercutio, all brag and swagger, is stabbed and staggers, drawing out his death scene, spewing bitter wit and bright red blood, the articulate joker caught in a maelstrom of hate. Romeo is stiff with anger, murderous with grief. The air stinks of revenge. We applaud. A plague on both our houses.
Yeah, that Danny Pearl case really affected me as well.
And another story that's going on in this book is the fact that I as the speaker, am traveling towards marrying my husband, my current husband, and my only husband, I should say, at the end of this book, I'm Catholic and he's Jewish, and so some of these poems do think a lot about the idea of Jewish people and their place in America and their place in the world, which was something, you know, people were thinking about after September 11th.
Oh, absolutely, and still are.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
In another poem, you know, I quote Daniel Pearl saying, I am a Jew, my mother was a Jew, which were his last words.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Now, are you cognizant when you're writing of that fine line between art and maybe confessional poetry, which a lot of people have discarded?
Well, I wrote these poems now 5 and 6 years ago, and my most recent book of poems does not use the I pronoun. They're all in third person. So it's interesting for me to be reading intensely poems that I'm writing in now is actually quite different. The I is very useful. It's a very useful device, but it seemed a time in the world where speaking obliquely was not helpful. Or I should say in reverse, speaking clearly was helpful. In the midst of, you know, a time that very few things seemed clear.
And now we've reached a point in this culture that a lot of people are longing for people to speak honestly.
Right.
Which is what you were doing in these as well.
Right.
Yeah. That will never go out of vogue. I hope. Now you teach private poetry students. Tell us what kind of advice you give them.
Oh, my gosh. Well, it depends on the student. You know, I have a number of adult students who are at different points in their writing career, and some people need to be challenged, and some people need readers to share things with, and some people need a coach to get through the end of putting together a manuscript. Mm-hmm. So,
and then they all come to you actually as working writers, correct?
Yes.
So they already know that they're on this road to being poets.
Yes, very much.
And many
of them are far more accomplished writers than I am.
No kidding.
And I learn a lot from them, which is fun.
Uh-huh. How do you measure an accomplished writer compared to yourself?
Well, they're good. My students write great poems. You've had my student Peggy Billings on.
Peggy Billings was wonderful.
On your show.
She was.
I'm very honored that Peggy lets me, calls me her teacher, and lets me call her my student. It does feel the other way around a lot of times.
Uh-huh. Now, do you think it's important for people to read other poets?
Oh, very
while
much.
They're working
and one thing
writers?
I do a lot. In fact, one of my students and I right now are reading every book written by a certain poet. So I do find books for us to read together and discuss. That's very important.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's something people forget to do sometimes. They get focused on their own poems.
Well, I've heard writers say that they try not to read a lot of other poets while they're working because they're afraid they'll be influenced by the person's voice.
Young poets frequently are.
Yes.
As I was.
There were a million Sylvia Plaths when I was a young woman.
And that's a natural stage of a writer's development.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a reason to not read. But I think serious poets reach a point where they are firm in their own style and voice, and reading gives them ideas but doesn't overwhelm their own vision.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But people have different ways of working.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, yes. Now, can I get you to read one more piece from audience? This one's called New York Times. And can you
even sitting and reading the New York Times? I was a member of an audience. In this poem, I mentioned the previous poem, which was set at the Green Party Convention, which was held in Ithaca that year, upstairs at CSMA. So that's what I'm mentioning when I talk about it. New York Times. Okay, I'm getting old. I'm hungover and headachey from those 3 beers I drank at that darn Green Party party. I have a slow morning. Finally, Kenny and I are getting ready to garden when I notice the front page of the Times, a photo of people perching in the broken windows of the towers, wreathed in ghostly smoke, about to, as the paper delicately says, fall. It's a long story detailing the last moments of those trapped innocents, quoting their desperate emails and cell phone calls. The paper quivers with despair. I stand in the kitchen, trowel in hand, beginning to read. That's gonna upset you, says Kenny. Come outside. So I do. I leave the paper, I leave the last words, and I go out of the dark kitchen and into the light. We dig deep into the compost pile. We spread that rich dirt in the beds, and we plant seeds for flowers, because, yes, we are fools enough to still love beauty and life.
Mm. And do you think at this point that beauty and life are winning out in this culture?
Well, I'm always going to cheer for them. I think so. You know, children are being born every day, and they come into the world beautiful and full of light and life, and there's a lot of darkness. I feel like when you leave Ithaca and go out into America, you notice that the rest of the world is a little different.
Uh-huh.
And I feel sometimes that America is caught in darkness, and that also thinking people are pretending that things are not what they are, that they're better than they are. But I have great faith in human beings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To
prevail.
Go deep into themselves and live honestly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now you mentioned that the new writing that you're doing is much different than this.
Mm-hmm.
This was just recently published, but it's an older work.
Right.
What's the new stuff like?
I just finished a manuscript of prose poems called Salt. And there's a lot of gardening in those poems, too.
Really?
My 4-year-old son is a passionate gardener. So there's a lot of babies and gardens, and there's a lot of politics in those poems, too. There's a lot of war. I became interested in the idea there's a lot of young women soldiers right now, working class young women, which is who I was a long time ago. And so there's a number of poems about working class young women soldiers in this as well. And then poems about women who are being mothers and things like that. I've just finished that. I'm not sure what I'm going to write next.
And this will be out sometime soon?
Well, no, I don't know.
So you're still
finished.
You're working on other pieces to be included in this collection?
No, I finished writing it, and now it's sitting in the drawer.
And does it have a title yet?
Salt.
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 Okay.
I grew up in the Salt City, so I'm allowed to call a book Salt, I think.
Well, Bridget, we have run out of time. I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Tish.
We wish you well on your future projects. And I really do recommend, go out and buy Audience. It's a wonderful book, especially those of us who live in this region. It's all about us. Thank you, Bridget.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.